everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the American media's distorted narrative about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Two guests, James North. I'll introduce him in a moment in greater detail. He'll be on for the first half of the program. In the second half of our program, we're going to go to a woman who has done outstanding reporting on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Her name is Alison Weir, W-E-I-R, and she'll be talking about aggression against Palestinians, the ideology behind human rights violations, according to the United Nations. This is a story you will not hear or read in the mainstream media, but it's important, and I believe that we should listen carefully what our two guests are saying and then weigh that against what so-called truths and facts were given by everyone else in the media. Now to our guest. James North is the editor-at-large for MondoWise, an independent news site informing people about developments in Israel and Palestine related to United States foreign policy. MondoWise was founded by the progressive Jewish and veteran journalist Philip Weiss in 2006 and has become a leading Jewish voice supporting the Palestinian struggle for human rights. In our opinion, it is one of the best news and analysis sources committed to the highest standards of journalism that deals with events unfolding in the Near East. Prior to joining MondoWise, James was an independent journalist and author who has reported from Africa, Latin America, and Asia for 44 years. He is the author of Freedom Rising, Life Under Apartheid Through the Eyes of an American on a Clandestine Journey Through Southern Africa. The website is MondoWise, MondoWeiss.net. Nice to have you with us today, James.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your kind words about MondoWeiss, which is a website that's making a difference.
We believe that. All of our mainstream media, left and right, offer up a one-sided image of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that is fundamentally pro-Zionist. So I ask you to first give us a historical understanding of the image that is being portrayed by the media to the American public. And then, is this because many prominent journalists at the news and media networks are themselves pro-Zionists, such as David Brooks and Paul Krugman at the New York Times? Or are there other influences such as the Zionist lobby and our federal State Department and intelligence agencies that dictate how the media should narrate the conflict? The form is yours.
Well, thank you for the question. It's a broad question, and I'll try as best I can to answer it. I will point out that a couple of months ago, I spoke at a conference in Washington, D.C., hosted by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, an independent magazine, which has been in operation for decades now. And in the modern era of technology, my half-hour talk is available on YouTube at no cost. So if you just Google how the New York Times rigs news on Israel-Palestine, you'll see me there talking away some of the points that I'm about to make to you. I try and stay away from the motivation for why. First of all, the news is slanted terribly, consistently in the New York Times and in other publications. I chose the Times to focus on because it's the single most important source of news still for Americans and people elsewhere about what's going on in Israel-Palestine, particularly since other media outlets have closed their foreign bureaus. You know, 20 years ago, the Chicago Tribune had a reporter there, the LA Times, probably the Philadelphia Inquirer, and now due to financial reasons, for the most part, they've closed down. The cable networks do a very, very poor job of this. I mean, it's they don't even bother to cover it. So the Times is extremely influential. And what I've done over the past close to 10 years now at MondoWeiss is just scrutinize the stories, the articles that are written about from Israel Palestine. And I should state just at the outset that although I've spent nearly all my career in alternate media, I'm not automatically biased against reports from the New York Times from overseas. I have been friends with some of their reporters over the years. I've seen some excellent, excellent work in other parts of the world. I mean, David Kirkpatrick, who covered the Egyptian uprising in 2011 and for years afterward and did a magnificent book about it afterwards. I mean, so in other words, I'm not automatically biased simply because it's the New York Times, but a close look at what goes on there and the kind of coverage that they do. And I'll just start out by making a few points here. One way that the Times, and I invite your listeners to scrutinize Times articles the same way that I do. To start off, the Times uses slanted language. For instance, by any fair-minded understanding, those Jewish Israelis who have settled across the Green Line in the West Bank, which is an occupied territory, are colonists. They should be called colonists, but the euphemism has grown up over the past few decades to call these settlements, and they're called settlers, which is a more neutral-sounding term. Now, the Times is not the only media outlet which uses this language, but it certainly, it consistently says this, and as a result, many readers and many Americans generally have only the vaguest idea of the geography. You know, Edward Said, the great Palestinian-American thinker and writer who's unfortunately left us, he used to talk about the geographical elements of this. So if you call it settlements, we have no idea. Another use of distorted language is when the Times refers to the West Bank as disputed territory. Well, in legal international legal terms, it's occupied territory, not disputed territory. The only disputed is that 150 countries believe it's occupied, and Israel believes it's not occupied. And I guess maybe the Trump administration now may also use the term disputed. But there again, language is used to distort. And again, I personally don't think this is it's not a conspiracy. It's simply the way in which this paper has done business and has done reporting from that area. A third example is the Times will consistently conceal Israeli extremists, you know, people with very strong points of view, whether colonists, settlers, or military people. I mean, one example I use is there's a very well-known colonel in the Israeli army called Ofer Winter. He's basically during the last invasion of Gaza in 2014, the last large-scale invasion, Winter basically told people, the press there in Israel, that God had intervened to protect his soldiers and him while they were attacking Gaza. He spoke in Hebrew, but the translation was, "We were protected by clouds, clouds of divine honor. We, all the warriors, were suddenly covered by a heavy fog, which came to us throughout the attack, which prevented them from being shot at." Now, any reporter, reporters are good at smelling what a good story is. So the idea is any reporter who's beyond their first year of journalism school should have shot over to Colonel Ofer Winter and interviewed him. And then there are other people to interview, some of these settler colonist leaders in the West Bank. I mean, they're capable of making very hair-raising statements about ejecting every single Palestinian from the West Bank and throwing them all into Jordan. And these are people who are influential and important in Israeli politics. However, the Times somehow can't get around to finding these people. It doesn't interview them. You rarely will see them. You'll have to look in other sources to see what they have to say. So these are some of the examples. Another way that the Times distorts is by quoting Palestinians as little as possible. I'm sure you and your listeners are aware that some 20% of the population of what is Israel within the 1967 lines, 20% of those people who live there are in fact Palestinians or Arab Israelis, or whatever term you want to use, but you almost never see them quoted in the New York Times. And then when it comes to Gaza and the West Bank, which are occupied territories, again, you'll rarely see Palestinians quoted from time to time. But for every quotation from an Israeli, for every 10 quotations from an Israeli, you might see one Palestinian. So they become invisible. The Palestinians become invisible. Another thing that the Times does is it will occasionally publish what I could only describe as a pro-Israeli propaganda article, which could have been written by the Israeli publicity department. One example that I use in my talk is a big article a few years ago about how Israel is tremendous successes in terms of water use, that they're doing desalinization, they're fighting drought. It's a dry area of the world, the Middle East, but Israel is successful. And there's a huge article on the front page in which, but you had to wait until the 23rd paragraph to discover that Palestinians were even mentioned. And people who follow this area are aware that water use by Israeli settler colonists in the West Bank is an area of tremendous dispute. There is limited water in the aquifers there, and the Israelis take it for their swimming pools, and the Palestinians don't have enough to water their own agriculture. So the idea was that here was a article that basically only told one side of it, ran on the front page of the New York Times, and was basically was PR for Israel. Another thing that the Times routinely does is it avoids interviewing Israeli human rights organizations. Now, it wouldn't go anywhere near Palestinian human rights organization, but there's a very impressive group called Beit Salem, which is Hebrew for "in God's in His image." It means that all of us are created in the image of God, and this organization kind of functions like an Amnesty International within Israel and Palestine. They go out and they do reports and they interview people who are victims of human rights abuses. And they have a website, and they publish, and they do some remarkable work, but you're rarely going to see them quoted in the New York Times, rarely. So they just ignore these people. Another example, I mean, I can go on for a while here. Another example is using the passive voice. We saw a lot of this during the Great March of Return, which was the basically nonviolent effort starting a little over a year ago by Palestinians who live in the occupied or surrounded area of Gaza to try and march up to the border and protest the fact that they're basically being held under very terrible conditions, blockaded, and medicine isn't getting in, and et cetera. So basically, and what happened was that the Israeli military lined up on the Israeli side of the border and opened fire and killed somewhere over 100 Palestinians. These protests went on every Friday for weeks and weeks. The way the Times reported it, not always, but much of the time, was it used the passive voice. So you would see a headline, or not even a headline, but in the article it would say, "Four Palestinians died in clashes yesterday along the Gaza border." When in fact, they just died. What caused this? In fact, a more accurate statement would have been Israeli snipers killed four Palestinians. And going back to the Israeli human rights organization I just mentioned, Beit Salem, they right on their homepage had run a big banner headline that implored Israeli soldiers to not fire on these civilians. But you wouldn't have read this in the New York Times. So another word that's used in the Times is clashes. There were clashes yesterday between Israelis and Gazans along the Gaza border. Okay, well, the point with that is that it's very vague. I mean, as I said to my audience during my talk, if I were to go out into the audience here and hit four of you in the head, and some of you were to fight back slightly, you could describe what happened as a clash, but it wouldn't be accurate. I provoked it, and you were basically defending yourselves in this case. So there's another example of loaded language. Another thing, your listeners may be finding this tiresome, but another way in which the Times distorts is it distorts the timeline. By that we mean that a series of events take place, but the Times will pick one of them to make it look, and the idea is to make it look like the Gazans or the Palestinians started the trouble. First of all, Gaza and the West Bank itself are occupied and have been occupied since 1967. So occupation, particularly the kind of blockade that Israel uses to surround Gaza, is basically an act of war. So the provocation starts from Israel. But on top of that, what you can do, you can try this experiment the next time you read an article in the Times. It'll say Gaza. The headline will say something like, "Gazans launch rockets against Israel. Israel retaliates." That's a classic headline that we've seen over the past year regularly. But if you dig down deeper into the article, get to about the 10th or the 15th or the 27th paragraph, you'll see that before Gazans launched the rockets, Israel did a provocative act by, they may have tried to assassinate some Gazan political leaders, or they did something. In return, the rockets were launched, and then in return, Israel attacked back. So it makes it the overall implication is to blame the Gazans, to make it seem like they're the ones who start the violence all the time, which is entirely inaccurate. There's more. Another way in which the Times distorts is it goes to the Israeli military, and basically the way I put it is it takes dictation. It asks whoever the spokesman is. Right now it's this lieutenant colonel called Jonathan Conricus. They had a different guy, Peter Lerner, a few years ago. But basically they will put out multiple paragraph statements giving the Israeli point of view, and the Times will basically just write down what they say and fill like 6-7 paragraphs in a row. Now, technically speaking, they're not necessarily endorsing what the Israeli military is saying. They're simply telling their side of the story, but they're not going to then go over to the Palestinian side or the Gazan side and take 7 straight paragraphs in a row and put their side of the story. They simply don't do that. So basically, at the beginning you asked me what was the motivation here. Is it because the reporters are Zionists or whatever? I don't know any of these people personally, so I would hesitate to say what their personal motivation is. But one thing I can say is that anyone who reports in an American newspaper or TV from Israel-Palestine is under tremendous pressure from Israel and its supporters in the United States. Tremendous pressure. People on our side of the story have tried to counteract some of what their reporting says, but they get greater pressure from the other side. I mean, there are websites devoted to attacking these very reports that I've just cited to you that, to my mind, to our mind here at Mondo Weiss, show bias, anti-Palestinian bias. There are pro-Israel websites and pro-Israel forces that will say that these people are actually biased against Israel. It's extraordinary, but they do say that, and they put a great deal of pressure on them. And just how the reporters respond to this, it's hard to say. But basically, I think what the Times has to do, it has to be able to pick its most thick-skinned reporter that it has to cover Israel-Palestine, and the editors have to be prepared to stand behind that person no matter what kind of pressure they get from the pro-Israel, pro-Zionist forces. And if they don't do that, then we're going to continue to get this poor coverage that we've been getting.
We appreciate that insight. Would you use the Gaza peace demonstrations that you alluded to at the border fence last spring as an example of how the media distorts the actual events that were taking place? I recall we were mostly being told that the 6-week-long demonstrations, which resulted in numerous injuries from Israeli military sniper fire, was being orchestrated by Hamas. It is estimated at least 110 Palestinians were killed and over 13,000 were wounded, many being shot multiple times with up to 5 bullets. Yet it was activist groups and civil society figures in Gaza who organized itself under the banners of the Great March of Return, as well as We Want to Live, as protest against price hikes and the dire living conditions the citizens across the Strip were living in. The average American is still clueless about the horrid and inhumane conditions that Gazans live in, and I imagine this is similar to something you too have witnessed in South Africa. However, the media wrote a different narrative that you presented. Now, would you give us an idea then of what life is like today and what it has been like today in Gaza, and what happens when some person fires rockets into Israel, and Israel uses that as a pretense to take its jets and demolish dozens of homes. And with a large body count, and also what it does to infrastructures, and if I'm not mistaken, many of the infrastructures that it intentionally targets are infrastructures that are on the list of things you cannot do if you're in a war, like Clinton bombed Iraq's water treatment centers, hospitals, and places that were necessary for life for the average citizen, not the military. And what has Israel done to make life for the average citizen, not just those that they are politically or ideologically opposed to, difficult, that the media does not cover at all? I have yet to see any American media go into Gaza or the West Bank, show us the actual day-to-day living conditions, and then show the stark contrast. As you were mentioning, they'll have water for their swimming pools, the Israelis, or the settlers, and yet just close by, there's no drinking water. So if we had a better understanding of how people are actually living there, it might better frame your argument. Please continue.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you summarized it quite effectively. I haven't been to Gaza myself. I have been to the West Bank, but I haven't been to Gaza myself. But let me just repeat what you said right at the outset, which is that we can learn a lot of what happened during these great marches and return simply by looking at the casualty figures. As you said, more than 100 Palestinians were shot dead during this. Another 13,000 were injured. Many of these people lost their lower limbs, a leg or two legs in some cases. And at the same time, for the first year or so of these so-called clashes, one or two Israelis were wounded, and that was it. Now, I guess a couple, two, 3 weeks ago now, three or four Israelis were killed by some of these rockets. But still, the disproportionate death toll and injury toll, you know, it immediately tells you that serious human rights violations are being committed by Israel. I mean, human rights lawyers, which I'm not one, will tell you that, you know, you're allowed to defend yourself, but only with proportionate violence and only if you feel that your own life is in danger. And you can certainly not argue that the Israeli military was in this condition. And so what they've committed war crimes. And as I said, the Israeli human rights group Beit Salem has accused them of committing war crimes. Again, this is an Israeli human rights organization, not a Palestinian one. Now, I would say this, a slight addition to your point that the U.S. media haven't gone in there. The writer Max Blumenthal has been in Gaza, along with the writer-filmmaker Dan Cohen. Now, Max, a few years ago, did a book called The 51-Day War. It's an excellent book. We reviewed it at Mondo Weiss. He was there during the 2014 attacks. And more recently, he and Dan Cohen have done a film which you can get online, you can rent online or buy online. I don't have the title handy, I'm sorry, but the two filmmakers are Max Blumenthal and Dan Cohen, and they did a film about Gaza under attack and what the conditions are like. And you're absolutely right. You're 100% right. If a film of this type were to show on one of the major networks or on whatever the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour is calling itself these days, I mean, people would turn against the Israeli policy tremendously. So it's important that these type of alternate reports, alternate books, then this alternate film be basically kept isolated and people are simply unaware of it. And again, there's all this vagueness about the whole geography of the situation. I mean, the effort, the Times and the other U.S. mainstream media have basically promote the narrative that Israel wants peace, that the Palestinians do not want peace, that they're bloodthirsty, and that every once in a while they launch rockets trying to destroy Israel and push Israel into the sea. It's a complete lie.
The Democratic Party seems to be becoming more polarized on the Palestinian issue. The old rank-and-file Democrats, such as Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer and others, are closely aligned with the Zionist lobby. In fact, when Biden, who is Roman Catholic, appeared on a Jewish television program, he stated, "I am a Zionist." You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. Then there is a younger wing of the Democratic Party, especially the new freshmen in Congress, who realize that the plight of the Palestinians is analogous to the struggles for civil rights that the United States had to endure. Do you witness any indication that American support for Israel may be challenged or waning, and what might be the consequences of that for the Palestinians?
Well, that's an excellent question. And, you know, at Mondo Weiss, because we're one of the first places that people turn to when they're looking for an alternate, alternate and accurate explanation of what's going on, we notice this. I mean, younger people, younger American Jews, younger non-Jews are increasingly turning against Israel. They're increasingly seeing through the mainstream narrative. They're increasingly angry about it. They're going out on the streets to demonstrate. You know, there's a group of young Jews called If Not When Now. If Not Now When. They're on Twitter, and they regularly go to these events and disrupt. They go on these birthright trips that the Zionist establishment sends young Jews to Israel to try and propagandize them, and they disrupt the, you know, they I shouldn't say disrupt. They ask pointed questions about the occupation, about the second class status of Palestinians within Israel. And so without question, the times are changing. Now, the problem is that it's moving slowly, and particularly in Gaza, in the West Bank as well, but particularly in Gaza, the occupation is just taking a devastating toll on the people there. It's basically an open-air prison camp. And so will enough people in our country and elsewhere in the world change their minds before the tragedy in Gaza gets even worse? That's a tough question. But there's no doubt that. And another point I would make too is that within Israel itself, which I found during when I've been there, is that points of view that are considered or were considered in this country unfair, anti-Zionist. You know, you can say things in Israel that you, Edward Said made this point many years ago. You can say things in Israel and they won't necessarily agree with you, but they won't start calling you an anti-Semite or trying to discredit you that way. So there's in a way more room for expression in some sense in Israel than there is here. But yes, I would say it's very, very heartening, and at Mondo Weiss we see this all the time, that there is definitely another area you can see this is in the New York Times. I mean, I was speaking to you about its news coverage, but its editorial coverage is interesting too, both the editorials the paper runs and, you know, the op-ed pieces where they invite other people to come in and give their opinions. And some of these, many of these have room for comments, you know, the public can comment if you're signed up to the Times. And, you know, the level of understanding and criticism of mainstream pro-Israel policy is just growing all the time. But again, you know, there's a real emergency, particularly in Gaza, and the fact that our side is gaining, it's still tragic that the people continue to suffer there. And although we're gaining, we're not going to, you know, win this debate overnight.
I've also noticed that instead of having at least reasonable debate in American media, that anyone who criticizes anything about Netanyahu, his Likud party, or the Knesset's position, any of the human rights violations, of which there are many, against the Palestinians, immediately you're called anti-Semitic or anti-Jewish, or if you're a Jew, self-hating Jew. But I believe that there's a growing segment of American Jews who oppose the current Zionist ideology, and Netanyahu's government and its human rights abuses of Palestinians are now becoming more clear to them. I recall your colleague, Philip Weiss, has said that he believes that ultimately Israel will lose the Jewish state because of its stubborn arrogance to refuse all compromises the Palestinians offer. And I think it was Yasser Arafat who even offered a proposal for Palestinians to create a state on only about 20% of the land. But the Israelis have refused that. It wasn't good enough. Therefore, aside from the Trump administration's completely uncritical acceptance of the Zionist regime, do you see a trend that in the long term, the Zionist state will ultimately collapse? Or do you believe that, on the other hand, any criticism of Israel could now be considered hate speech and you could be either fined or arrested, that the anti-boycott movement is being challenged, and that they're going to cause so much destruction to the actual living structure, with more than 100,000 structures completely destroyed and more than 200,000 people unable to have any form of reasonable existence in the occupied territories? Final thoughts, please.
Yeah, those are two very good questions. You quite accurately pointed out that, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, the BDS movement, is a nonviolent effort to bring about the promotion of human rights in Israel-Palestine. And what its opponents have done, instead of trying to counteract our arguments on the merits, they've tried to maybe criminalize is a little too strong of a word, but they've tried to basically force people who work for state governments to sign pieces of paper saying they won't even advocate for this. I mean, they've tried to curtail our right to free speech. And what we're advocating for are measures that have been devised themselves by Palestinians and are nonviolent. I can't repeat that enough. So you're absolutely right about that. As far as the occupation goes, I fear that the occupation is going to continue, but it certainly won't continue forever. I mean, I did some work for Mondo Weiss a year or so, a little couple of years ago now, about Algeria. And Algeria was under French occupation for 130 years, but the Algerians never completely gave in. They never thought that, and unfortunately, they did win their freedom after a long and terrible, terrible war in which large numbers of people, most of them Algerians, were killed. So what we're trying to avoid in Israel-Palestine through the pressure from outside, through the BDS movement, is the occupation cannot last forever. Will it be there in 100 years? No, it can't be. Will it be there in 50 years? I don't think it can be. Will it be there in 5 years? Yes, probably. But in the meantime, what we need to do is, apply this, again, nonviolent pressure. Ayman Odeh is one of the Israeli-Palestinian leaders. He's in the Knesset. He's a remarkable man. I had the good fortune to meet him when he was touring the U.S. a few years ago. And he's a lover of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. His first stop when he got to America was to go to Atlanta and visit the church where Dr. King used to preach. And yet you won't read about him in the New York Times, or you'll hardly read about him. And so you're right. I mean, the only hope to prevent a true cataclysm in Israel-Palestine over the next, there's enough violence already, but it is nonviolent pressure. And one of the first steps in that is this campaign for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. There's nothing anti-Semitic about it. One of my great-grandfathers was a rabbi. I'm not going to have anybody tell me that I'm anti-Semitic or a self-hater, whatever. It's disgraceful that people would try and argue this way.
I appreciate very much your work, your insights, and the fact that you continue to fight for people who do not have a voice in the mainstream media or in the government of the United States. It says a lot when 100 senators, not one single one, decline to sign a letter of allegiance to Israel. Within that allegiance, in effect, they're as if they were a NATO member, that if anything happens to them, we immediately come to their defense. We're giving them billions of dollars a year, somewhere around $4 billion, right, that we know of, probably more otherwise. And yet not a single member of our Congress has the courage to say we should reassess this based upon the merits of people's character, their actions, and their proven desire to live peacefully with one another. My goal is to see Palestinians and Israelis both have long and healthy, productive lives, sharing the same area, but without the need for all of this dominance. It's hegemony of the wrong kind in the wrong place, and we should be aware of it. Our Congress clearly is not. Thank you, James North, for being on. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going out to Northern California, where standing by is Allison Weir. That's W-E-I-R. She's a journalist, highly respected, an author, civil rights and peace activist, and the president of the Council for the National Interest, which was founded by several former members of Congress. She's also the founder of the organization If Americans Knew, which analyzes and reports on U.S. media coverage of Israel-Palestine. She's presented briefings before Congress on the U.S. and the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, and has lectured widely at universities, Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, Yale, Berkeley, and she's received a variety of awards for her outstanding investigative journalism, including the Phi Alpha Literary Society for Courageous Journalism on behalf of human rights. She writes for Counterpunch, Antiwar.com, Project Censor, Global Research, and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. She also has a book called Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel, which is an extraordinarily thorough, meticulously sourced document bringing forth a story that is simply unknown in the United States about the true history of U.S.-Israel relations and the origin of the State of Israel. Her website is ifamericansknew.org. Nice to have you with us today, Allison.
Thank you for having me.
I feel there is a fundamental question that needs to be asked about our mainstream media, and especially the New York Times' refusal to cover the events of violence occurring in Gaza accurately. We have seen over the years international human rights organizations repeatedly charging Israel with unwarranted and discriminatory violence against the citizens and infrastructure of Gaza, including schools, clinics, hospitals. But no matter how harsh the condemnations, Israel gets a pass. Nobody, certainly not the U.S. and our allies, are holding Israel to any account on any level ever for war crimes. Our government manages to find Israel's military actions justified, and the media simply toes the same line. So the big question is how such aggression can be justified. And it is the right-wing Zionist faction that largely justifies Israel's horrendous treatment towards Palestinians. So the issue is then, would you please analyze for us in detail how do Zionists, both in Israel and the United States, use the human rights violations of the past, namely the Nazi effect, to eradicate Jews during the Holocaust as a means to justify their human rights violations against Palestinians?
Israel created through a war of ethnic cleansing, which is well documented by both Israeli historians and American historians, and of course Palestinian historians. We have detailed this in with considerable accuracy. In 1948, Israel was created through a secular movement called political Zionism. Ever since that time, it will periodically, when Israeli forces commit massacres against Palestinians, which they do every few years, most recently against Gaza in 2014. Actually, not a few days ago, there was a smaller massacre in which they killed 23 Gazans. Today, I guess it was yesterday, they shot or injured at least 60 people in Gaza. So this has been going on for many years. And yet, the media misrepresent that, give us very filtered coverage of it. And most Americans have no idea that this was done and that it's still going on today. Interestingly, right now, a number of us were very curious because supposedly there was going to be a frontline documentary shown last night. It was advertised on the San Francisco KQED station. It was advertised on the PBS website. If you do a search, you see the PBS listing, but when you click on it, it's been taken down. It was called One Day in Gaza. It was apparently is a documentary that was largely made by the BBC in conjunction with Frontline that was shown in Britain. It's about Israeli forces killing, I believe it was 45 Gazans on May 14th, 2018. And according to a report in the UK Guardian, it's extremely graphic and moving. But it was pulled, it appears, from US TV. So it was not shown on KQED. There's no indication that it was shown on any PBS station in the United States, even though it was listed ahead of time. So this apparently very powerful, very strong documentary, accurate, you know, factual documentary about what happened in Gaza that was shown in Britain was not shown to Americans. This is typical of what goes on. American taxpayers give Israel over $10 million per day, and that's about to go up even higher than that. So we have a real connection to what's going on in Israel-Palestine, and yet we are probably the least informed population about what's going on there. This is how this tragedy continues, because American taxpayers, American voters, ultimately have the responsibility for our governmental actions, but we're not informed about our own policies, about the degree to which U.S. Middle East policies are being driven by the Israel lobby, and we're uninformed about how Israel uses our money. As you know, this particular case indicates, a documentary by the BBC in conjunction with Frontline, shown in England, not shown in the U.S.
That story in time will come out to the public. What we need to know is, are the people of Palestine or Gaza and the West Bank, to a lesser extent, are they being treated as if this were South Africa during apartheid, where in effect they are living in an open-air prison with very few rights and a substantial deprivation of quality of life? Could you address that, please?
Yes, they are. This has been documented by a number of humanitarian agencies, including the Red Cross. It's been documented for a number of years. Israel controls the borders of Gaza. It also controls the borders of the West Bank. Those are just a little bit more porous. But we have millions of people being kept virtually in prison, because if you cannot get into, or especially cannot get out of an area without going through armed guards, that's a prison. So both the West Bank and Gaza actually are prisons, but Gaza is the one that's suffering more, and it's a bit more of a prison than the West Bank. So the Red Cross has documented that, and other agencies have documented that, Israel has perpetrated a 12-year siege blockade against Gaza. It has prevented many medications from getting in, food items, necessary items for daily life. This blockade has caused children to have their growth stunted. Imagine if those were your children or your grandchildren. It has caused 52% unemployment among the population of Gaza. And according to the Red Cross and other experts, this blockade of Gaza is illegal. It violates international law. Among the laws it violates are the Geneva Conventions. And yet it goes on year after year, barely mentioned by U.S. media, who almost never mentioned that it's illegal and what it's doing to the population of Gaza.
I was curious about the reasons why the majority of the Arab world is silent about Israel and Palestinian conflict. In fact, now Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states like the United Emirates are allied with Israel more than they are with the Palestinians. So Gaza's Muslim neighbor, Egypt, is also aligned against them. Therefore, there's the general perception the rest of the Arab world and the Middle East regions are not supportive of the Palestinians at this time. And we never had that discussion in the United States. One of the most common arguments we hear to justify Israel's periodic attacks on Gaza is that Hamas and even ordinary Gazans acting on their own, continue to threaten the lives of Israelis with frequent rocket attacks. You've argued that this rationale is largely mythological. How so?
Well, because let's look at the real facts here. Again, any American that researches this independently will discover the same things I've discovered. You know, 18 or 19 years ago, I also tilted towards Israel. I'd seen the Exodus, etc. But here are the real facts about what's going on. When I traveled to Gaza and the West Bank in early 2001, I traveled around Gaza already at that time. I have these photographs. I saw entire neighborhoods in Gaza that were bullet-riddled. Large apartment units that had been full of people were in ruins. This was, you know, I witnessed extreme military violence against the people of Gaza in February and March of 2001. Anybody can check out the fact that no rockets had yet been fired from Gaza. They weren't fired until apparently April of that year. Four rockets were fired in all of 2001. So there was massive violence against Gazans. Then finally, some resistance individuals and groups tried firing up largely homemade rockets. In the entire time that they've been used, so we're talking about since April of 2001 through today, those rockets have killed a total of about 40 Israelis. During that same time, Israeli forces have killed way over 6,000 Gazan men, women, and children. That's almost never, that's never reported by the U.S. media. In the past year, Israeli forces have killed at least 293 Gazan men, women, and children. 293 in the past year alone. During that same period, Gazan resistance forces, you know, small groups or individuals, have killed a total of six Israelis. So we're talking about 293 compared to six. And yet, the media focus on those six and, you know, consistently frame the issue as Israel defending itself from rockets and from Gazans when the chronology is the opposite and the death rate is by, you know, many degrees different than we're being led to believe.
I have one concern that supersedes almost all other. I have a great respect for all life. So one dead Palestinian or one dead Israeli is one too many, in my opinion. I would like to see, like many people, peace in that area for both groups of people. But I'm very concerned that Israel, in alliance, with other allies such as Saudi Arabia and the United States and France and England, are attending to the goal of having a war with Iran. From all the analysis I've been able to see, that would be an enormous blunder. China and Russia would come to the aid of Iran. There would be a blockade of oil getting out. The price of oil would skyrocket. And Iran is not Iraq. It is twice the size of Iraq, and it has over 1 million people under arms, and they've been planning that day when they will be attacked. So it will be a long and bloody and costly battle, even with nuclear weapons being used against them, which is completely feasible in the minds of those war hawks who would commit this war. What do you see and what do you hear about this being the ultimate goal of having alliances in the Middle East that will justify a preemptive attack based upon some notion or false flag of Israel against Iran?
I think it's extremely dangerous to see what's going on right now. And as you say, the results would be, you know, cataclysmic. It would be extremely horrifying if this goes forward. But the seeds for that kind of war are being planted and have been planted for a long time. I mean, right now we see all these reports, you know, by the New York Times, for example, then other newspapers pick them up, by anonymous individuals in the White House telling us you know, things that they claim are true, but they won't put their names to it. Julian Barnes in the New York Times, to me, seems to be the new Judith Miller. Judith Miller, as you may recall, and hopefully your listeners recall, but most Americans probably don't, was the New York Times reporter who kept telling us about the so-called weapons of mass destruction that that Iraq supposedly had. Of course, that turned out to be a lie. But based on that lie, the U.S. attacked and destroyed Iraq. By destroying Iraq, we greatly destabilized the entire region. That destabilized Syria, led to the violence in Syria that has caused, you know, flowed over into Europe, causing tragedy there. So those same claims, those same types of claims that were in the New York Times that led to this disastrous invasion of Iraq. By the way, Israel had wanted us to invade Iraq. This was written about widely in the Israeli media, where Israeli media talked about the fact that neocons, pro-Israel neocons in the United States, were pushing the war against Iraq in the U.S., so they were basically responsible for it. This was reported in great detail in Israeli newspapers. So we see the same thing going on now in our newspapers with intelligence that now and then, if you read it, not even between the lines, buried down lower in the story, will be the intelligence supposedly that tells, that claims that the Iranians are about to attack U.S. forces. That intelligence came from Israel. Israel for decades has wanted the U.S. to attack and destabilize Iran. This has been written about by the Project for a New American Century in the 90s, by the Yanon Oded plan. This is an Israeli strategic think tank, and Israel wrote about that plan and recommended the destabilization and balkanization of the Middle East in 1981. And in the early 1950s, it came out in the diaries published by Moshe Sharet, that were written by Moshe Sharet, published in Israel. Moshe Sharet was the second prime minister of Israel. He had 12 volumes of diaries. None of the full diaries have never been translated into English, but we have a small volume that gives some of it and shows that even the 1950s, Ben-Gurion and other Israeli leaders were talking about the need and how they would destabilize and damage the neighbors around Israel, Egypt, Iran, Syria, and other countries. So this targeting of Iran that would have horrifying consequences, not only on the region itself, but on Americans, worldwide consequences, possibly, if it goes forward, has been pushed by Israel for many years. If people read the reports carefully, even in the reports, there are indications that, you know, clear indications that Iran does not want a war with us, is not going to do something that would trigger a war with the U.S. Why would they? They, you know, we have massive power. Israel has massive power. Israel has at least 100 nuclear weapons, possibly as many as 400 nuclear weapons. Iran's not going to trigger a war with either Israel or the U.S. And that's clear. If you read the full articles carefully, even within those articles, but if you don't, if you look at the headlines, if you listen to Fox News, then, and of course, you know, probably half the voters listen to Fox News. They're getting the impression and have been getting this impression for a number of years that Iran is a danger to Americans, which is untrue. That Iran is about to attack U.S. forces, which is untrue. So the American public is being extremely misinformed about the situation in Iran, and that's dangerous.
Allison Weir, thank you very much for being on and sharing your insights. And her book is Against Our Better Judgment. Her website is ifamericansknew.org. Thank you very much. I appreciate you sharing your time with us.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity.
Thank you for listening. I'm Gary Nall for the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Brother, what's up? This is a deep recording, man. I can dig it. brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war.